Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting for the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Today we start off with an interview with Steve Wickham, who is running for the Albany County Legislature, 30th District in Gilderland.
Then we have an interview with Bruce Campbell, who will be in Albany next Wednesday at the Save the Pine Bush dinner, about his book on oil bomb trains.
And then we start with a recording of our own Meg Mahorn speaking about the Extinction Rebellion at a recent Green New Deal forum.
And then we finish up with two live segments, Peter Lesser, Executive Director of the Egg, and then following that we'll have an interview with Tina Lieberman and Jeff Corbin about a proposal for community choice aggregation in the Capital District, where communities buy green energy together for local residents.
But first, the news headlines.
The Times Union reports that Democrats in the city of Troy will see a rerun from 2015 as Mayor Patrick Madden faces a primary challenge from former City Council President Rodney Wiltshire. Wiltshire said he decided to run after seeing Madden's administration raising property taxes, instituting a trash fee, and closing the South Troy and Knickerbocker Park swimming pools. Madden said his administration has stabilized the city finances by regaining the state's and financial markets' confidence in the city's fiscal operations.
The city of Rensselaer has issued a request for proposals for Killian's Landing, a $200 million development on the city's waterfront. The 75-acre mixed-use development project would include apartments, businesses, and possibly a brewery. Developers have until April 12th to apply.
The two houses of the state legislature have released their versions of the state budget. They contain some significant differences with that of Governor Cuomo. African-American lawmakers are blocking the governor's proposal to legalize marijuana, saying it does not do enough to provide economic opportunities to those who were most harmed by the war on drugs. Lawmakers do not agree on the details of various criminal justice reforms, such as eliminating cash bail. It is unclear whether a system of partial public campaign financing will be enacted. The assembly wants to raise taxes on wealthy New Yorkers, a move opposed by the governor.
Lawmakers have decided to deal with climate change after the budget has been passed in early April. The assembly, however, wants to reject the governor's proposal to install two new gas turbines in Arbor Hill to power the state capitol complex, and instead want to invest in renewable energy such as geothermal, solar, and wind. The assembly failed to include the governor's proposal to ban single-use bags, which, while the Senate went further and also imposed a fee on paper bags in an effort to promote reusable bags.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation last fall found that a lining system meant to contain potential leaks from getting into the ground at the Dunn Construction and Demolition Debris Dump in Rensselaer, the state's largest, was flawed. According to the Times Union, Texas-based Waste Connection, which owns the 98-acre facility, has agreed to pay a $10,000 fine and upgrade pit liners that remains to be built under a consent order with DEC. Judith Enck, a former regional administrator for the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and my wife, said that the dump liners are the only defense against widespread groundwater contamination. She questioned the modest amount of the fine.
Nancy Saltzman, co-founder of Nexium, described in the media as a cult-like group near Albany in which women were branded with the leader's initials and forced to have sex with him, pled guilty Wednesday to charges contained in a federal racketeering indictment filed last year against six people in the group. The defendants were charged with a variety of crimes, including racketeering, identity theft, money laundering, sex trafficking, and extortion.
Hundreds of activists and immigrants from across New York were in Albany on Tuesday to call on Governor Cuomo and state lawmakers to allow driver's licenses for immigrants in the country without legal permission. The issue has been debated in New York for a decade without action being taken.
The Times Union reports that the city man being tried on charges that followed a woman's fatal overdose last year was convicted of manslaughter and concealing a corpse on Tuesday. On March 14, 2018, the lifeless body of Keisha Richards, 24, was found on a Kent Street sidewalk. Police determined she'd been overdosed and that the defendant had organized a drug party with her.
That's it for headlines. Up next, we're talking with...
We're talking with Steve Wickham, who is planning to run for the 30th District of the Albany County Legislature. Steve, welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much.
And what exactly do you have to do in order to get yourself on the ballot in Albany County?
Right now, we have to collect petitions to qualify. So, you know, you need, I think it's 3.5% now, they lowered it, of registered Democrats to qualify to be on the Democratic line. And then other lines we could potentially be on as well. But I'm a registered Democrat. So right now, we've got about half of our goal. We're planning to get much more than that.
You mentioned before we went on the air that one of your issues is climate change. What would you as a county legislature like to see done on climate change?
Well, one of the things that I think an easy pickup would be to have county buildings using solar and convert to geothermal. That's something that we could just do. I would like to support the towns of the county to start using these community aggregation it's a CCA. I was forgetting exactly what the abbreviation stands for, but I think you have somebody else coming on to talk about that later. And, you know, we could do other things, you know, make sure that we have convert our fleets to electric vehicles, you know, have better busing systems. We need to increase, actually, transportation. There's, in terms of having access for, you know, public transportation, a good part of the county doesn't have any. And if we were to add some routes to other parts of the county, then we could have more access for people, especially people who have mobility issues. STAR program only goes 3/4 of a mile off of established routes. And so where there are no routes, those people don't have any access at all. And if we just doubled that, we could actually close all the holes and add some routes.
Now, in our headlines, there was a mention of Governor Cuomo and his desire to have a waste-burning plant in Sheridan Hollow, I believe, to supply energy to the state office buildings. Now, what's your stance on that?
I really don't believe that burning trash is a really good way to go, although it's one way we can deal with our program.
Let's just clarify a bit. It used to burn trash. Now what he is proposing is to install 2 new gas turbines to provide both electricity and heat for the Empire State Plaza.
Yeah. Okay. So that's because when you said that I wasn't sure.
Trash.
So, as I understand it, the Sheridan Hollow project is going to be running 24/7, burning basically frack gas, which doesn't make any sense at all because we just banned fracking in New York. So why are we going to start buying it from other states to power our capital? Plus, that particular area, you know, it's basically an environment, or, you know, environmental injustice, because you're going to put a lot of people at risk for, you know, the extra pollutants that are put in the air. And what's kind of amazing is that both Oklahoma and Colorado state capitals have gone green. They use actually geothermal to power their, you know, heat and their capitals. So I don't understand why we're going in this direction to use fossil fuels.
You mentioned earlier, before we get on the air, that one of the issues you're concerned about is the issue of transparency. Do you want to speak a little bit to that and maybe, you know, one or two other issues you're planning to raise in your race?
Yeah, well, in terms of transparency, I think one of the things that we could do very easily, if anybody's ever tried to go to the Albany County Legislature meetings downtown, it's a bit of a hassle. Unless you're in Albany itself, it's very difficult to get down there and make your voice heard. And one of the things I'd like to see us do is either have small groups of county legislators or the legislature as a whole body go around the county and have legislative sessions in other towns to make it easier for people to have access. I think that alone would help people be more, give more people accessibility and transparency in terms of how things are working.
So the first step is you have to achieve the 3.5%, you said, right, in votes?
Yeah, we actually, I'm in a primary, so we need to get much more than that, because that's only like 108 signatures. And so we're looking to reach closer to 500 people before, just to meet them. And I'm going door to door, basically, to do that.
Okay. Another thing that I just heard today is that CDTA is planning to make a number of cuts in its services. Are you aware of that? And
if it was announced today, I did not catch that. Okay. Yeah, I will look that up as soon as I get out of here. Because
they said there's a lot of routes that are not sufficient, you know. And when you were talking about expanding into more rural areas, I wondered how you would find that feasible, you know, financially.
Yeah, well, that's definitely going to be something to look at, you know, because, you know, places are underserved, but we also need to have people use the services. And from
as a common good, right?
Yeah, my research shows that people tend, you know, there's like this, you got to get to a certain level of service before people actually start using it. It has to be very regular and, you know, useful. You know, you got to be able to get to a point where people have enough access before they will use it. So
we have about 2 minutes left, Steve. So you can end with, you know, you have a website around people to get more information about your campaign. I know one of the issues that's been kicking around, just been introduced in the Albany County Legislature, is the issue, I believe, of both banning single-use plastic bags and putting a fee on single-use paper bags. What's your bag agenda, and then how do people find out more about it?
Sure.
In about a minute and a half.
Yeah, so I'm really surprised that this is still an issue. I spent a summer of 1989 in the Netherlands and shopped at a grocery store called Aldi's, which we now have here. And as I was checking out the first time in Aldi's in Leiden, the Netherlands, I was just assuming they would pack my bags, and they didn't. You had to buy a bag or bring your own and fill it yourself. And, you know, so that was in 1989, and we're still arguing about whether or not it's feasible for stores to charge you for bags and whether or not you should bring your own. I just think it makes more sense for people to be doing everything they can to reduce, recycle, reuse, and compost. So,
get a website, Facebook page?
I do. Everybody, number. Yeah, the best way to reach us is at electsteve2019.org, and that's STEVE.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Steve. That was Steve Wickham, who's running for the 30th district for the county legislature of the county of Albany.
So up next, we're going to have an interview with Bruce Campbell, who's author of The Lack Mechanic Rail Disaster, Public Betrayal, Justice Denied. On July 6, 2013, 47 people were killed in Canada when a train carrying oil exploded, the type of trains that come too often to the Albany, Port of Albany. Bruce will speak in Albany on Wednesday, March 20th at 7 p.m. at the Save the Pine Bush Dinner, Westminster Presbyterian Church, 85 Chestnut Street. We're joined by Bruce Campbell, who's a Canadian author who wrote a book about the 2013 oil train explosion and lack Mactantic, Quebec. Obviously, the oil bomb trains have been a big issue here in the Capital District with the Port of Albany. Bruce is going to be speaking next Wednesday, the 20th, at the Westminster Presbyterian Church, 85 Chestnut Street in Albany. Save the Pine Bush dinner, normal routine. You can join him for dinner at 6, or you can come for free to listen to Bruce in his presentation at 7. So, Bruce, maybe for people who are not familiar with this particular rail disaster, can you give them a little bit of the background?
Yeah, I can. It's nice to be with you, Mark, and I'm looking forward to being in Albany. This happened in the summer of 2013. It was a train that was carrying 72 cars laden with oil from the Bakken region in North Dakota, so Bakken Shale. So I imagine a lot of Bakken Shale still goes through your area. It was misclassified as low volatility. It was very high volatility, judging from what happened. It was bought by a refinery on the east coast of Canada, New Brunswick, and so it was about a 2,500 mile journey. It went through the U.S. It came into Canada from Detroit and into Windsor. Went to Montreal. Was picked up by a short line railway called Montreal, Maine and Atlantic, owned by a Chicago entrepreneur named Ed Burkhart. And it was that train in the early morning of July 6, 2013, it was a runaway train, and I can go into the details, but it was a runaway train that derailed in the middle of town, exploded, and it was, it was a summer, balmy summer night. There were still people partying. It killed 47 people. And multiple explosions, some of which reached about a 16th of Hiroshima. So it was a huge set of explosions. It eviscerated the town center, spilled 6 million liters of Bakken crude, which is the largest land-based spill in North America. And so kind of those are roughly the details of, in short, the details of what happened. Of course, my book goes into, the whole period beforehand, leading up to, and aftermath, and the current situation.
So what led you to actually write the book?
Well, that's interesting. I watched on TV and YouTube, like millions of other people, and I just couldn't believe that this was happening so close to home on the Canadian main border. And but as I listened to the coverage, and I mean, my background is policy research, and I researched deregulation, privatization, austerity issues for a long time. And I saw the elements of that emerging as I listened to the debate, and I thought I could write about it. And it was summer, and I was on vacation. I had time to spend, actually. And so when I got back to work, I learned that my close colleague lost three members of her extended family in that disaster. So it kind of put a whole new dimension to it. So I actually started writing about it in 2013. I wrote actually three reports for the organization where I was executive director. And then I was encouraged to actually culminate my analysis in a book. And then that book was released in the fall. And that's the book I'm going to talk about.
And so you were is an adjunct professor at York University, Faculty of Environmental Studies, and you mentioned you were executive director of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. So why is this situation, this accident, relative to the present situation both in Canada and the United States?
Well, I mean, I trace a long trajectory of the erosion, the removal of safety protections, and the changing power relationship between the regulator and the regulated industry, to the point that you know, that it was a kind of a Russian roulette situation. You had a weak and dysfunctional regulator. You had an increasingly powerful industry. You had something called regulatory capture, or a cozy relationship. And, you know, so then you had this booming situation of oil by rail, which began in 2009, was hitting its peak in 2013. Whether it was from Alberta, whether it was from Bakken. So all of that happened. And then there was a kind of a panic on both sides of the border by the regulator. Here's the regulator that, that's supposed to be, first and foremost protecting its citizens, whether south of the border or north of the border. And this had happened. And so there was a big rush to demonstrate that they had learned the lessons, taken safety into account, and then it was kind of all done. And this was like, we're going on 6 years now. And after that initial period, memories fade. People think, everything's been done, but everything hasn't been done. And what my analysis showed is that there are some major safety risks, major safety gaps that still exist. They exist on both sides of the border, and that that the window of history is still open for a repeat. And this at a time when oil by rail is again at record levels. Oil by rail volumes, a lot of it's it's going east, it's going south to the Gulf, it's going to the Midwest. Export volumes from Canada are at, 350,000 barrels per day. It could get as much, with the Alberta government wanting to increase oil by rail
Bruce,
by another 120. Yep.
We only have about 2 minutes left, believe it or not. I know you're going to be speaking next Wednesday at the Westminster Presbyterian Church, Save the Pine Bush Dinner, 85 Chestnut Street. So you sort of indicate that, things haven't changed, safety lessons have not been learned, that these trains remain a problem. And I know one of our local friends here at the radio station, person worked on Conrail. So the whole issue that they only had one engineer or one staff person on this particular train?
Yeah, no, and that's, and I tell the story of how that happened. Here's this delinquent railway. It was the only railway that got permission to run its trains by a single operator. And this, this guy, locomotive engineer, was put in an impossible situation. The deck was stacked against him. And I go through all of the conditions that kind of mitigated against him that were present that evening. But it is, right after. As sort of admitting it's like it had screwed up, it prohibited single person trains, but it's still doing it in Maine, and there's still a big push on at the federal level in the U.S. to put in place single person train provisions, and so there's that's kind of a major, I think, a major danger if that is allowed to happen. Some states have prevented it, but most haven't. And that's that's a real danger on your side of the border.
Well, we've been talking about Bruce Campbell's new book, The Lack Mechanic: Rail Disaster, Public Betrayal, Justice Denied. Bruce, if people want more information, find your book, you get a website they can check out?
No, but I don't have my own website, but they can go to the publisher. It's James Lorimer and Company, and they can get access to the book. I think the book is certainly available online and possibly at local independent bookstores. Oh. I'm not sure, but it is available.
Okay, and people can join them next Wednesday, the 20th, dinner at 6, lecture at 7, Save the Pine Bush, Westminster Presbyterian Church in Albany. We've been talking to Bruce Campbell, and this is Mark Dunley for WOOC.
That was Bruce Campbell, who will be speaking about oil bomb trains in Albany next Wednesday. Meg Marone of the Green Sanctuary Committee of the Albany Unitarian Church talks about the relationship between the Extinction Rebellion and the Green New Deal at the GND Forum at the Albany Public Library on March 9th. This will be the second of three segments by the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
The second speaker at the Green New Deal Forum at the Albany Public Library on March 9th was Meg Marone, who is with the Green Sanctuary Committee of the Albany Unitarian Church.
So the focus of my talk is going to be on the Extinction Rebellion and also the whole idea of forming a local group that supports the national and international movements of Extinction Rebellion. So I'll open with a bit of a definition, and then I think it would be helpful to talk about how the Green New Deal overlaps at a macro level with the national and local Green New Deal, and then also where it diverges from the Green New Deal for sure. Some of the slides will have quotes from the from the Extinction Rebellion website. So the purpose of the group is that it's to grow capacity to face the reality of the ecological and social crisis with love as our principle, guided by reason and conscience. And I worked with a lot of friends from Troy in preparing this presentation, and we decided to also definitely communicate to you that the Extinction Rebellion founders in Europe have a very strong sense that they want the movement to have an emotional core to it. So at the foundational level, there's an articulation of the Extinction Rebellion of grief, and the whole idea that given all of the statistics that Howie mentioned within his speech, that it's appropriate to feel grief over the situation, the existential conundrum that all of us find ourselves in together. And that actually we can move forward in a more honest, driven, and empowered way if we're honest about the grief of the current situation. A few of the people who were foundational in Great Britain to the coming together of people. The first person is Roger Hallam, and he is an organic farmer, and he's been farming for 20 years. And his PhD is from King's College, and he teaches about effective radical campaign design. Then there's Gail Bradbrook, and she's an economic justice campaigner. Her PhD is in molecular biophysics, influential in one of the major Extinction Rebellion actions, which was to block all of the major passageways into London in November of 2018. Another huge figure within 18-year-old climate activist who skipped school in order to sit in front of the Swedish Parliament to speak her piece. So let's definitely try to hear from Greta. And gave a speech basically calling out the corporate and governmental interests that Howie once again mentioned in his speech. The whole idea that the entire corporate state is complicit within the problem that we're facing. So those are the main figures that were foundational to the forming of Extinction Rebellion. And they have four major, we're talking about documents that are coming from Great Britain. There are four major demands that Extinction Rebellion is calling for, that governments need to tell the truth about the climate emergency and work alongside media to communicate this to citizens, that the government needs to work to legally binding policies to reduce emissions to net zero by 2025, which even 2025, a lot of people see as being a very, you know, that still could be an extremely dangerous position for us. But in the phrasing, you'll notice that it says legally binding, and this would be the point of divergence right now for the state of the Green New Deal, because obviously there's just an incredible amount of controversy over even getting the Green New Deal passed as a resolution, let alone getting it to the point of being a law with consequence. And I think for people to really feel hope in the fact that there could be some sort of change, or at the very least action, in the face of this situation, there has to be consequence for the entities that have caused the situation. Right now, even with the Green New Deal resolution, there's no consequence for any corporation that still uses fossil fuels. There's also a call for the establishment of a National People's Congress to oversee changes as part of creating a democracy fit for purpose, just transition that prioritizes the most vulnerable people. So the idea that built into this movement is the idea that the most vulnerable, the power structures should be tipped on their heads. Indigenous sovereignty should be a main concern. Reparations and remediation led by and for Black people, Indigenous people, people of color, poor communities, these are all built into the foundational documents. It's also like Gail Hasbrook and Roger Hallam, they were all involved in Occupy as well. But the fact that there is this rhetoric right from the incipients of this group is actually an important movement ahead from even the Occupy movement, which was addressing an intersectionality of economic human rights issues and the environment. There's also the idea of establishing legal rights for ecosystems to thrive and regenerate in perpetuity, repairs of ongoing ecocide, and the idea of trying to maintain a living planet for all. So in terms of how to get this done, there's the call for nonviolent direct action. And right now, the foundational documents and the website encourage people to congregate in the major cities. So the whole idea that I formed a Google group for Extinction Rebellion Capital Region, but the whole idea that our purpose in the Capital Region would be to maintain community support for each other and also to be preparing to take action with the big national events within cities. So the April 15th is the first major national and international Extinction Rebellion Day, and the whole idea that people would go to New York from the Capital Region and support where the real power base is within major American and international cities. So here's where, that's an image I don't have time to show you of people shutting down the five major bridges in London in November of 2018. But just again to emphasize that if you would like to join Extinction Rebellion, which the Green Sanctuary Committee of the Unitarian Church is 50 people, and they've signed up to join with Extinction Rebellion. The whole idea that the focus is on grief and communication and forming community in terms of true vulnerability, getting people to communicate about both joy and sorrow as we figure out how we're going to push ahead in terms of approaching the crisis. And that whole idea is also about regenerative culture, a culture that isn't about denial, ignoring these problems, consumerism, but creating a culture and a community of people who can actually trust each other and communicate with each other, and art and music all coming about because of that.
And that was Meg Marone of the Green Sanctuary Committee of the Albany Unitarian Church, a discussion, the intersection of the environmental movement, Extinction Rebellion, and the proposed Green New Deal.
For those just tuning in, I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in from 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary. So residents in the Capital District the last few years have been working to develop Community Choice Aggregation, or a CCA. In a CCA, if a local municipality joins it, then all the residents of the community will obtain their electricity from the CCA unless they opt out. This gives the CCA sufficient number of members to negotiate for lower prices and an energy mix based on clean renewables rather than dirty fossil fuels. You still get your electrons through the CCA, but the local utility company, in this case National Grid, is still responsible for the mechanics of delivering it and general customer service. We are joined now by two members of the local CCA steering committee, Tina Lieberman and Jeff Corman. I should note that I'm also a member of the steering committee. Welcome, Jeff and Tina.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start out with the elevator speech. I'm a resident of Troy, you know, for instance. Not actually imposing it, but if I was a resident of Troy, why would I want Troy to become a member of the CCA?
Well, thanks, Mark, and thanks for having us on. When you plug in your phone, when you turn on the lights, the energy that you get is determined, where it comes from is determined by national grid. So about a third of our energy comes from fossil fuels, about a third from nuclear power, and about a third from hydroelectric power. And a few percentage points, less than 10%, comes from renewable sources. And that price also fluctuates a lot over the course of the year. Now, you may, and the residents of Troy, may want something different. And so community choice aggregation gives us a chance to have local control over where our energy comes from. And it also allows us to set a price that is actually competitive with what National Grid provides. So if we want to decide that we want to have green renewable energy and not have fossil fuel, then the way to do that is through a community choice aggregation. And that is how we could actually wind up having a massive impact on our ability to reduce our fossil fuel emissions.
Now, CCAs are very common out west. What are their status here in New York? Have they taken off at all?
Well, thanks again for having us. Yes, we could talk about there's one CCA just right now that has been in existence. That's the Westchester Power CCA. It's part of Sustainable Westchester. It started about just over 3 years ago. They had a three-year contract. They had about 20 municipalities at first. About 14 of them chose the 100% renewable energy option. And recently, they decided to renew a contract, and now they have a two-year contract going forward. And now they're up to 26 partnering municipalities, and 24 of them have chosen renewable energy. So it's really it's very impressive at how well the CCA is doing. Westchester is really leading the way and showing that it can be done and that it can be impactful. They have saved hundreds of thousands of tons of greenhouse gases from going into the atmosphere. Plus, when you look at their pricing, they priced out a bid for the normal brown energy mix, which is about a third of coming from fossil fuels, about a third from nuclear, and about a third from hydro, and just a little smidgen from solar and wind. And they compared that with they got a price for 100% renewable energy, and it turned out 100% renewable energy was only 0.2 cents more per kilowatt hour than the brown fossil fuel mix. So that really was it's just a statement as to how the prices for renewable energy are coming down. And so most of the municipalities now are opting for 100% renewable energy. It's not even, it's like hands down, let's go for the renewables.
So can you maybe give us an overview of where we are locally in terms of developing a CCA for the Capital District? And maybe you could highlight some of the local groups that are helping to put this together or trying to put this together.
Sure. So we have a really exciting coalition of obviously environmental groups in the region, like the Sierra Club's Hudson Mohawk Group, SCEAC, the Schenectady County Environmental Advisory Committee, 350.org, Save the Pine Bush. But we also have a broad coalition also of social justice groups, including some churches in the Schenectady area, like Schenectady's First Reformed Church and their Creation Care Committee, also PAWS, Solarize Albany County, which is obviously an environmental organization. So we have a really nice broad mix. And then on our steering committee, we have a wide representation as well from, again, these environmental groups to I myself. I'm a professor at Union College. I'm interested in this for a variety of reasons.
What towns in the local area have expressed interest in CCA?
In the local area, we have interest being expressed by Knox, New Scotland, Bethlehem, Schenectady, Glenville, Saratoga Springs, Niskayuna. Thank you. I think I've covered them all. And then Albany also has a resolution that's in committee right now to look at CCA. And we're hoping that Troy will start to look at joining CCA, because once we create this buyer's club for renewable electricity and we lock in a contract, it would not be easy for another community to join in until that contract is done. So it would be wonderful if these communities and Troy could kind of at least get some information now so that when we go out to bid a contract, they could join in and they could be ready to join in.
So what are some of the most common questions or concerns that get raised both by officials and the public when you talk about CCAs, and you know, how do you respond to some of them?
Well, Tina referred to one of them, and that is, I think we all are used to thinking of renewable energy as being the Cadillac option, a lot more expensive than what the fossil fuel dirty energy is going to be. And that's not the case anymore. The fact is that the prices have come down tremendously. We have a lot of unused hydroelectric power or underutilized hydroelectric power in this state. And so we can wind up providing clean, green, non-polluting energy at or below the price for fossil fuels. So that would, I would say, be the first. And the second is that when people hear about, oh, well, a municipality is going to become the energy supplier, they might think, but I don't want my city to now be building wires and having trucks going around. But instead, National Grid will continue to service our supply. They'll still hook us up. They'll still maintain the wires and handle the billing. It's just simply a matter of we get to determine where our electrons come from.
Right. So it's really like democratizing our energy supply, because now we get to choose. The people get to tell their municipalities, their officials that they've elected, hey, we want this choice. We want to decide where our electrons come from, what the source is. There's no obligation for a municipality to actually sign on to the contract unless they're happy with the prices that come back. And so I think that's a very important part of it. It's not an obligatory thing. And the price that comes back will always be lower than what National Grid is currently charging its residents for the brown supply. So whether if you choose a green, if the contract comes back with a green supply, it's going to be lower than what residents are paying now. If there's an option that's not 100% renewable, let's say it's 80% renewable, that will also be lower than what residents are paying now.
Can you maybe also outline, what is the process is going through right now to try to get, towns involved? And I understand there are other CCAs in the state that have recently begun to emerge besides Westchester?
Yes. So actually, the southern tier, the Binghamton area, is right on the verge of starting their community choice aggregation, I believe, like this week. So they're about to have one. In their model, they wanted a choice of 100% renewable or not. So each municipality got to choose what they wanted, but they're all still part of the same aggregation. We also have, there's interest in the Rochester area, and right here in the Mid-Hudson Valley, we have a community choice aggregation, a CCA buyers club forming, which will definitely lean toward renewable energy, and it includes the city of Poughkeepsie.
So why wouldn't a municipality do this? This seems so common sense.
Well, we think it is. It's a big change for them, and we understand that they want to do due diligence and do the right thing for their representatives. But ultimately, I think that what we hope to be able to convince them is that they're going to be able to actually see the contracts and be confident that their residents are going to pay at or below what their current National Grid prices are, while also significantly reducing our carbon emissions. So I agree with you, Mark. I think that this is a very easy decision for municipalities. It's a matter of garnering public support in order to be able to convince them.
Now, the last rumor I heard was we didn't actually have a website yet for the Capital District CCA. So if people want to get more information about what is a CCA, what's going on locally, and they want to get involved, what are some of the ways they can best do that?
First, if they want more information in general, just go to the NYSERDA website, NYSERDA, New York State Energy and Research Development Authority, and just Google Community Choice Aggregation, and you'll get a whole bunch of information, frequently asked questions, et cetera, about Community Choice Aggregation. This whole program is, by the way, completely supported by NYSERDA, by the Public Service Commission, who came up with it, and it's one of the 10 high-impact action items that communities can take to be a clean energy community, which is an important NYSERDA initiative. And then if you're interested in a Capital Region CCA, contact us. So I can put my, I can say my email address and send an email. So my name is Tina Lieberman. So it's TLIEBERM1@gmail.com, or reach out to WOOC and they'll refer you to me.
And my email is CorbinJ, C-O-R-B as in boy, I-N, J at union.edu.
Well, Jeff and Tina, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today at the Hudson Mohawk News Magazine.
Thank you. It was fun.
Indeed. Thank you.
Now, we had been hoping to have Peter Lesser on from the A to talk about their upcoming thing, including, I believe we're going to be having an event here at the Sanctuary with the 100th birthday celebration of Pete Seeger on May 4th. But you don't see Peter yet, so we're going to go back to our food diary segment. We have our weekly food diary with correspondent Amy Harlan, who will be discussing Women in Grains with baker Erin Dietrich.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran. Welcome to another food diary.
Oh, no, Amy. I think we're going to... Guys, I'm sorry. I'm not sure what... We're getting a UPS delivery.
Okay.
And my dogs are, I currently have two dogs. My sister's dog is here, and they're both losing their minds.
Right.
So, unfortunately, my house is small enough that there's nowhere I can go. Can we hang on just one second?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. This is right at the beginning, so we don't have to deal.
I'm so sorry.
No problem.
Oh, my goodness, guys. Hey, barley. Whiskey, barley, sit, barley, whiskey, sit. It's all right. It's all right. You're all right. Oh my goodness. Yeah, they're both really kind dogs that get very worked up over package deliveries.
I can understand. It's exciting stuff.
They're really into defending the household, and they're, as you can probably hear, fairly large dogs, and they both have some, they don't look like it, but they both have some Rottweiler in their past, so their barks really
they mean
go
it.
For it.
They mean it.
All right, guys, are we done? Is that, has the package been, we're still in process. But, yep, he's leaving. Okay. I think the house was successfully defended.
Awesome. You're still there. You can still talk.
I can still talk. I haven't been attacked by the UPS man yet. I'm pretty sure he's done. Oh, boy. Can't tell.
What are you getting delivered?
You know, it's probably actually stuff for my friends in Egypt, because apparently it's very difficult to get... certain, like, you can't really get international deliveries. And so, say you want a book, you can't order from Amazon in Egypt. Say you need medicine, that's like a pretty common drugstore thing here, you can't get it there. So they're shipping, they're having a bunch of stuff sent to us. We're going to bring an extra suitcase over to Luxor, filled with things like a laptop for one of their coworkers and stuff like that. So
awesome.
I'm guessing that we're getting another delivery of, like, you know, just like household goods or something like that to fly to Egypt with.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah. Man, this is taking forever. We're almost done. Come on. All right. Come on, Dax. Come on. Come here, Whiskey. Come here.
You want to take a picture of me, Felix?
Like the dog memes.
All right, now they're okay.
Okay.
I believe we can now start. Thanks, Amy.
Sure, sure.
Sorry, Felix.
Fine.
Okay, here we go. Hi, I'm Amy Halloran with another food diary. Oh, cut it out. Hi, I'm Amy Halloran, Food Security Manager at Unity House with another food diary focusing on women in grains. With me here today is Aaron Dietrich, who runs Signal Fire Bread. Aaron, welcome and thanks for coming along.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Oh, so thrilled. Can you tell us a bit about your bakery and where
Sure.
people can get the bread, where you make it, and where people can get it?
Sure thing. As you said, my bakery name is Signal Fire Bread, and I am based in Cold Spring and selling here in Cold Spring, New York, right now at the Cold Spring Farmers Market and at Marbled Meat, a great butcher shop in town, and Cold Spring Cheese Shop, and there's a restaurant called Dolly's down on the Garrison waterfront that gets my bread. So it's a fairly small network, but all right here in Cold Spring. But I'm actually baking up near Hudson, New York, in Livingston, at a bakery that was recently put into play by Sparrowbush Bread. And Antoine Guerlain is the head baker there. And we are sharing space in his wood-fired oven and bake shop, and sharing labor and ideas and all kinds of things back and forth with our bakeries there.
It's so cool. And I've visited this bakery, so I have to say that it's in a former greenhouse, which is quite an extraordinary setting among the many extraordinary things of this handmade bread, hand-milled, lots of new stuff going on inside there.
Yes, it's a beautiful spot. It's on an organic hemp farm. And, yeah, like you said, there's that greenhouse aspect on one side of it. So even in the middle of the winter right now, if the sun's really kicking up in the middle of the afternoon, you go out there, it's beautiful. And it's certainly unlike any baking experience I've had so far. I've mostly worked in, you know, windowless rooms, basements, things like that. So it feels really special to be in a space with windows and a view. And also to, yes, have access to that stone mill and dual arm mixer and that wood-fired oven that Antoine built. It's all really special stuff, and it definitely, I think you feel it in the bread, too.
I bet. The human touch is a real ingredient, and humans touching beautiful things adds up to great. The reason I invited you here is because you're a woman and you've worked in this baking field for a long time. I'm kind of collecting anecdotes and opinions and musings on what it is to be a woman in this field. With that introduction, what do you have to say about the experience?
I'm very proud to be a woman baker, certainly. And I was very lucky that early on I had a couple strong women bakers in one of my early jobs to sort of guide and teach me and show me ways in which women operated in bakeries. Because starting out in New York City, there's a lot of guys in the bakeries, and that is changing somewhat, but it's still a fairly male-dominated field, which I'm sure is why you're one of the reasons why you're asking this question. And I have to say that I had some good role models, but I did also have to really, really work to prove that I could handle everything that the men around me could handle. And I think there's an assumption based on my size and gender sometimes that maybe, you know, handling a 5-deck oven was going to be a little bit too much for me. And I think some of these assumptions I feel were made without even having the conversation with me. And it took me seeing that I was just going to have to throw myself into the hard stuff and ask for the opportunities again and again and really, really work to get to them in a way that I didn't perceive maybe a male coworker who was like twice my size, but certainly no more intelligent than me getting that slot at the oven right away. So it's certainly something I thought about a lot, is the ways in which just being a woman sort of made me have to put myself out there a little bit stronger, a little bit harder.
Was there ever any point where you wanted to say, quit it, I can't take this kind of environment where I have to prove myself so often?
Happily, no. I was never in an environment that was that intense. I was very lucky in that I have worked with people who, once I did prove what I could do, they more than happily gave me the things that I wanted to do. So I happily was not ever in a truly toxic environment. And I think I was very lucky in that. And I think that was also somewhat due to me sussing out situations before taking a job.
And seeing that you had the capacity to move through them rather than run up to
exactly.
too many walls. Yeah,
exactly.
That's
exactly.
great. What, you know, looking, you and I have been at events together where there's a palpable sense of dudes overlooking women in the room, even at very progressive baking events.
Yes.
What's up with that?
Such a good question.
Mm.
Such a good question. I think part of it is just that ingrained sexism and gender disparity that we still have across the boards, where women are being invited on the panels more. Women are being involved, I think, as head speakers at big events more. But I think there's still a lot of guys who are looked to as the experts, as the sort of old guard, and there's a way that new guard can still even fit into that somehow and feed that energy, that we look to men as the leaders. And some of it is, I think, just the issues that you see across fields of there still being more men in leadership positions than women. And I think changing that is really what it takes for those voices to be at the forefront, because we certainly have just as much to say, I'd say, and just as much experience in many cases as the guys. But professional baking has been a male-dominated field for so long, and, you know, you don't really see as many female millers as you see male millers. You don't see as many female bakers as male bakers, even in the supply industries and all the things that we need to be bakers. You're dealing with men most of the time. And I think when that's the case, it's just easy to sort of still fall into those male-dominated, vocal patterns. And I'm not sure why that is.
Yeah, I think it is going to take generations of change. This has been another Food Diary, Women in Grains, with Amy Halloran, Food Security Case Manager at Unity House.
And that was another Food Diary with Amy Halloran and with special guest Aaron Dietrich, focusing on women in grains.
And I will say one of my favorite male bakers, Matt Funicello at Rock Hill Bakehouse, has managed to find a new place in Glens Falls, and so his cafe is not going to be closing. But that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that daily dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07, held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Thanks for tuning in.